right. So good evening, everyone. Hopefully, hey, folks on Zoom, can you hear me okay? Thumbs up if you can hear me. Yay! Thank you. All right, so welcome, folks on Zoom, folks streaming live with us tonight. I'm so glad you joined us. This is class 4 of 6 of the Discovering Buddhism module called How to Develop Bodhicitta with Don Brown. We're going to get started in just a moment, but I realized last week that when I was making these announcements, I was muted. So I am simply referring to the weekly Kadampa Center, what's happening this week, email that goes out, and you too can get those emails. But there's a lot going on with online classes and online opportunities. So please pull that up. If you don't have it, you can subscribe to the email by going online and subscribing. But there are lots of other opportunities in addition to Discovering Buddhism. We have 2 classes ongoing right now with Buddhism in a Nutshell. One is in the mornings, and one is in the evening. On Wednesday evenings, there's practice to develop Lam Rim in our minds. And on, this Thursday at 12:30 in the afternoon, there is a Tara practice to eliminate epidemics. And then there's also a meditation circle on Sunday mornings at 9 o'clock. And then after that, join us again for Geshe-la's teaching this Sunday again at 10:30. He's teaching from Argentina. We had him last Sunday, and it was a lot of fun. It was great to see everyone online. So do bring that up and check out other online opportunities. There's a lot going on and a lot to take part in. And without further ado, I'll turn it over to Don.
Hope everybody's had a good weekend, good week since we last did this. I know a lot of, I think Geshe-la talked at length about bodhicitta yesterday, and I don't know how many people got an opportunity. Can you hear me? Raise your hand if you can hear me. Okay. Got an opportunity to hear Geshe-la teach, but apparently he had a lot to say about bodhicitta. And, my brother's here. He's hiding in the back. But anyway, I don't know how long he'll last, but I'm going to explain some of this to him. So bodhicitta is the thing that makes Mahayana Buddhism unique. And it's like the purpose of the goal of practice is Buddhahood, is to become fully enlightened. And the only reason you would even want to work that hard for that long is so you could, because only a Buddha can truly help others. Only a Buddha knows, can read people's minds, know exactly what to do to help people in any possible situation. So our aim is full enlightenment for the sake of others, which is cultivated gradually. It's not a natural, I would say almost nobody wakes up in the morning and thinks, I want to get enlightened for the sake of all sentient being just spontaneously. It is something that takes effort. In the beginning, it's effortful, bodhicitta, and then eventually when it becomes effortless bodhicitta, then what are we called? Anybody out there? I can't call on anybody. Yeah, what do you call somebody who 24/7 has the attitude of this Bodhi mind, this awakening mind. Not only that, they've actually taken a set of vows. 46 exactly. What are you? Bodhisattva, exactly. So sometimes translated as an awakening warrior, or a spiritual warrior, but it's somebody who actually sincerely in their heart of hearts has developed this attitude. And it's not easy. It is not easy to develop. As we all know, we've been practicing a little bit so far. I want to read a couple of quotes. This is from a book that we used in this class, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago when I taught it. I used it then. And this is Geshe Lobsang Gatsa. He was a head of the dialectic school in Dharamsala, which is basically the Dalai Lama's monastery is Namgyal Monastery, and there's a sort of a PhD program inside that monastery, I guess you might say. And he was the abbot of that program. So he's a very learned, very qualified master. And he wrote this book on cultivating the compassionate mind of enlightenment, or bodhicitta. But I'm just going to read the first paragraph. He says, "The generation of bodhicitta is the entrance into and the unique mainstay of the Mahayana." Okay, remember we practice Mahayana, the greater vehicle. And it's the greater vehicle because of bodhicitta, because of the goal is supreme enlightenment for universal living beings. So it's different than the Theravada or Hinayana, which is more aimed at individual liberation. Nothing wrong with that, but I'm just saying there's a different goal, there's a different intention in the mind from the get-go in somebody who's sincerely trying to practice Mahayana. So then he goes on to say, widely celebrated, it is the very quintessence of all Buddhist scriptural systems. So I'll say that again. Talking about bodhicitta now. Widely celebrated, it is the very quintessence of all Buddhist scriptural systems, a fabulous ambrosia of Dharma. The mere thought of it can banish all mental woes. Since it is one of the qualities that bodhisattvas hold dearest to their hearts, those of us who really want to engage in the Mahayana path should train meticulously in the cultivation of this mind. If, however, we fail to give it the required amount of attention, none of our practices can truly be considered Mahayana in scope. So, as we said, it's the most important attitude that we need to develop to practice the Mahayana vehicle, the great vehicle. And I can, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, whatever he teaches, he spends an enormous amount of time helping people to set up their motivation, their intention. As you know, the chief factor in karma is intention. The chief factor in karma is intention. Okay? And the most magnanimous intention that we could have is this altruistic intention to become enlightened in order to benefit all living beings. So right away, it's the most powerful motivation for spiritual practice. And any action, even the smallest action, done with that sincere motivation, creates like mountains and mountains of positive karma, positive seeds are being planted on our mind stream. Whenever we have this attitude where we're not, focused on just me, I, but we're actually focused on the happiness of all living beings, and we're trying to get enlightened so we can help guide others from whatever state of confusion and suffering they're in now to supreme enlightenment. Okay? So, there's actually a prayer.
Don, yeah. We do have one question about what you were just speaking on. The question is, so all Buddhas have bodhicitta, but Mahayana overtly practice it on the way to enlightenment?
Do they practice it? Oh, absolutely. Yeah, excuse me. You mean you, See, the Buddha, there are different stages, bodhisattva levels, you might say. And, the highest level is called Buddhahood. But there are different levels of bodhisattvas, but you have to have bodhicitta from the get-go. So these, you know, even the lowest level bodhisattva has developed this continuous mindfulness of bodhicitta. So we need to understand what it is, and then more importantly, to begin to do the practices that cultivate it. And by the way, I got the nicest letter. It was a note. I think it had been in my mailbox about 3 years, but I was glad to get it. Anyway, I'm not going to say who it came from. I can't remember right now, but it was a lady who had come to this class years ago when I taught it, and I had emphasized the importance of the meditation on equanimity, the very first meditation, you know, when we're developing bodhicitta. And she had said that it had really been, you know, we did it. I encouraged people to do it every single day during that six weeks course, and she was just saying what a difference maker it had been in terms of her life, attitude, and relationships and everything. It was really cool. So we can't, all of these meditations are important, but to develop universal compassion, we have to give up what? We have to give up our clinging, our attachment to some, and our aversion to others, and our sense of indifference to others. We have to do that. And so that's this attitude of equanimity. So we'll spend a couple of moments doing that meditation. But this is out of our prayer book. It's called the Prayer to Generate Bodhicitta by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. It's on page 229 of the Gold Prayer Book, if you have it. It's only a few stanzas long, actually.
I can take a picture and then try to share the screen.
Okay. All right. See, Bob, there's a Zoom capability here. I think there may be like 6 or 7 people on Zoom. How many people are on the streaming?
On Zoom, 2 on streaming.
2 on streaming, okay.
12 on Zoom.
Okay. I can't see everybody on Zoom. Oh, you did. Okay, good. All right, so we'll read this together 3 times. But the Dalai Lama will often do this whenever he's giving teachings. With the wish to free all beings, I shall always go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha until I reach full enlightenment. Inspired by wisdom and compassion, today in the Buddha's presence, I generate the mind of full awakening for the benefit of all sentient beings. As long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. With the wish to free all beings, I shall always go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha until I reach full enlightenment. Inspired by wisdom and compassion, today in the Buddha's presence, I generate the mind of full awakening for the benefit of all sentient beings. As long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. With the wish to free all beings, I shall always go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha until I reach full enlightenment, inspired by wisdom and compassion today in the Buddha's presence. I generate the mind of full awakening for the benefit of all sentient beings. As long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Now that's such a bodhisattva attitude. No matter what it takes, I'll stick around as long as it takes to dispel the miseries of living beings.
If you want to You might be able to see at least most of the people.
It doesn't really matter, but I was curious.
Oh, yeah, you've got... Yeah, that's as many as will display on your screen.
Yeah.
And if you want to see more, you can scroll to the right.
Oh, like this, I mean?
Mm-hmm.
What's my...
Is your computer a touch screen or no?
Yeah, it's okay.
Yeah, you can...
That's good. That's good.
Okay.
We're fine. Okay. We're doing a virtual office visit today. Talking about, you know, I was, as I was driving over here and I drove by the fairgrounds and I thought, well, wow, what a difference just a few months can make in the lives of everybody. You know, it's such a perfect example of how unpredictable samsara is. You know, we live in a world where there's just no way, you know, we can work as hard as we want to try to organize things so that they go the way we want them to, but there's no certainty. As long as we're caught in this process of uncontrolled causation called samsara, So now we don't know. The football season's probably going to get canceled, or maybe not, but maybe so. The state fair, weddings, school, graduations, proms, summer camps. I mean, everything is up in the air. It's just so amazing. And a lot of people are suffering a lot of mental, there's a lot of physical suffering for the individuals who get sick. But I think there's every bit as much mental, maybe I think probably more, mental suffering that's going on now. So here we're talking about the antidote to all mental suffering and actually physical suffering is developing this attitude of this mind of bodhicitta. So it's worth our time to think about it. Think about the steps it takes to develop it. Let's start out though with the breathing meditation. We'll do something real simple and, what I'd like to do is we're gonna count to 10, and as you breathe, and we're gonna practice doing the exhalation first, because that's the way the Tibetans like to do it. The exhalation and inhalation is one. Exhalation, inhalation is two. But as you exhale, I want you to say silently Om, O-M, the syllable, the sensor. Syllable Om. So you go Om, and then you inhale silently. You go one, and then you exhale Om, and inhale two, and then exhale Om, and inhale three. You go up to 10. If you get lost, start over again. No big deal. But your contract is with yourself is to bring your mind to one-pointedness. Just focus your mind 100% on what this process of counting and counting the breaths up to 10, the way I just described it. We'll do this for a few minutes. Pardon?
They may not have heard that.
Oh. Okay, I just hit the gong. So just relax your concentration. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to go through the different points that we did in the meditation last time, and I'll what I'll do is you can close your eyes and listen, you can take notes if you want to, but again we're going to go through these different points, and sometimes you see them listed a little differently. For example, those of you who are, they can't see it, can they?
I can share another picture.
Yeah. I think you can see it up here, but that's not really going to help you much. Doesn't matter that much. But anyway, can you put those points up there?
Is it on your screen?
Yeah, I can see it.
Yes.
Yeah, good. So we're going to start out with equanimity. Meditation or the contemplations, and remember we talked about how what we're trying to do here, our goal is to develop universal compassion and loving kindness, and so as long as we have a biased mind where we're biased toward the friends and we feel aversion toward the so-called enemies or the people, just we feel aversion toward a lot of people. They don't have to be, enemy sounds kind of heavy, but, sometimes we just walk down the street and we feel some kind of, we don't like the way somebody looks. The mind of aversion arises, and then the mind of indifference, which is probably, we're definitely the attitude we have toward the vast majority of people. So, it's really, this is like the foundation of both ways. Remember, we talked about two ways of developing bodhicitta. One way was the seven cause and effect, and the other way was the exchanging self with others. And so that we merge those two into these different meditations that we have listed here. But usually equanimity is not even included in that list, but I put it in there because it is absolute basic necessity for developing compassion. I mean, there is compassion that we have that's real biased, We always remember, I always point this out, when somebody we dislike suffers, where there's a danger that we could actually rejoice. So it's real important if we're gonna build this palace of bodhicitta that we start out with the mind of equanimity. So the meditation that we do mentally, we the different ways to do it, right? But mentally, we start out with imagining somebody that we would label a friend on the left, and you can imagine somebody that you attach to on your left. Somebody that you would either presently or in the past have felt aversion toward, or anger, or that you would label an enemy, whatever works for you, and then sort of a faceless person in front of you that we feel indifference toward, right? So again, we naturally cling to the friend. Why? Because usually they said something nice to us, they've done us a favor. They've been kind to us in some way, meaningful way, and we cling to the friend. The so-called enemy is somebody who we think has harmed us, right? So they've harmed us in some way, and so or just instinctively, we don't like them, and so we label them. We feel aversion toward this category of beings, and then indifference toward the strangers, right? So here's different ways. I'm going to talk about several different ways to try to create this even-mindedness that we call equanimity. One of the simplest ways, but not the easiest, but it depends on your attitude about rebirth. But we already, you know, one of the next meditations we're going to do is remembering that all sentient beings have been family in the past, have been like our mother, right? And so everybody's been our mother. So our friends, our mother of this life, I mean, the so-called friend has been our mother in this and past lifetime. I mean, in past lifetimes, excuse me, and in future lifetimes, they'll be our mother. All the so-called strangers who are countless have been our mother in past lifetimes and will again be our mother in future lifetimes. And then the so-called enemy has been our mother in past lifetimes and will again in future lifetimes. So they've all been, all these three categories of beings have been our mother and have been extremely kind to us. And so this is one of the ways to begin to break down these labels that seem so concrete and real of friend, stranger, and enemy. And that's another thing we need to remember, that they're empty. That the so-called friend is empty of being a friend from their own side. It's a label. And it's a changeable label, right? Because we all have experiences where friends have flipped and now they're either strangers and we wouldn't recognize them if we saw them tomorrow or today, or they're enemies now. So that's not a fix. Just because they're a friend now doesn't mean they're always and forever our friend. Could change. The so-called enemy, obviously with a few kind words, could that label, and again, there's no inherently existent out there, truly existent enemy that exists independent of my mind labeling it, just a label. It's changeable. So the so-called enemy could become a friend. Just a few kind words, an apology. Next thing you know, you have a relationship with this person that you couldn't even stand a sight of them a few hours earlier. And then, of course, all the strangers in our lives. I mean, every friend and enemy we now have was at one point a stranger. You know, and so all these countless living beings have been that are strangers that we feel indifference towards. And again, that can change. It's a changeable label. And again, in past lifetimes, they've been like our mother. So, and then we look again a little bit deeper at why are we attached to the friend? Why are we attached to the friend? And we go, well, the friend has been kind to me. They said nice things to me. Usually our friends don't point out our faults, right? So when we get by with a lot of stuff with our friends that we wouldn't necessarily, for example, the enemy would be happy to point out our faults, but the friends, a lot of times, they kind of overlook our shortcomings. So in a sense, the friend is the friend of what? Our ego. Our egocentric mind. It's our worst enemy. So the friend, our friend is the friend of our worst enemy. Our self-centered mind. So is the friend really a friend? Just think about that. Just something to, again, we're trying to break down these concrete labels of friends and try to understand why we feel so strongly about these three categories of beings. And over here is the so-called enemy, the person that we dislike, we feel aversion toward. And why do we, and why? Because they said something to us, they harmed somebody, they either harmed us or somebody we loved, or they did something that offended us. They offended me. They offended, there's a big emphasis on egos, on the ego. They offended me. So we label them enemies. Okay? So we label them object of aversion. So where did they come from? Where did they come from? They came from our mind. Our mind labels these beings enemy, and then we feel, we have this negative mind of aversion wanting to push them away. Well, what did they do to me? Let's just say they embarrassed me in front of a lot of people, or they stole my spouse, or whatever. You know, you figure it out. You come up with your own. And we all have people that have harmed us in some way. So what did they do? And from again, Shanti Deva in one of his texts, we mentioned this last time. If somebody hits you with a stick, you don't get angry at the stick. You get angry at the person wielding the stick. Well, the enemy is like the stick. The enemy is the vehicle by which our negative karma is coming back to us. Remember, what goes around comes around. So what's really wielding the stick? It's our self-cherishing, selfish mind that planted the karma in the first place. So our self-cherishing mind is the real enemy, and it dwells in our heart. That's the real enemy. So the karmic seed was planted, and now this person is coming back and harming us or harming somebody that we love or care about, and we label them our enemy. And then, who else but our enemy helps us point out our shortcomings? So our enemy is like a really helpful for spiritual practice, because they show us what we need to work on. If we're impatient, who tries our patience? Nobody. Our enemies are great for this. People that we feel aversion toward are great because they push our buttons. They show us areas where we need to work on ourselves. So they're very helpful that way. They help us develop patience and tolerance. Well, patient endurance is one of the Bodhisattva's six perfections. Without patience and tolerance, there are no Bodhisattvas. Without Bodhisattvas, there are no Buddhas. There's no enlightenment. So that so-called enemy is my ticket to enlightenment. That's my ticket to enlightenment. So we can begin to think about the so-called enemy in a whole different way, and now the label begins to break down. And we began to see them in a less fixed way, as not so negative. They're not all bad. They actually have some good qualities, and actually somebody loves them. Somebody does care about them. You know, probably their mother, not me, but probably their mother. But you know, we can begin to think in these various ways to break down these hard and fixed labels of friend, enemy, and stranger. To develop a mind of equanimous mind. Okay? This mind of equal regard for all living beings, not clinging to some, not feeling aversion toward others, not feeling indifference toward the vast majority of beings. We're having this sort of level-mindedness. And by the way, I think I said this in past classes, but I used to do this meditation every day. For years, I would particularly spend a lot of time meditating on the enemy and trying to think of reasonings to see this person in a positive light. And I find this meditation on equanimity so helpful for the mind. So I invite you to put some effort into it. So just for a moment, just let that sink in and do your own 1 minute equanimity meditation. Now this is the foundation. This is the firm foundation of that we need to build, like I said, the palace of bodhicitta. So the next of the meditations is now remember again, this requires let me back up just a minute and say that Geshe Lobsang Gatso said that the seven cause and effect meditation is for the slightly more dull-minded people. Not to say that we're dull-minded, but, you know, this is the first of those 7 points, seeing all sentient beings as a way of developing bodhicitta, I should say that. He said, but it's very helpful, it's very powerful, and combining the two is absolutely essential to developing bodhicitta. So these are important meditations, and we have to at least, you don't have to do anything, but I'm inviting you to creatively align with the idea that you've had a past lifetime, that the first moment of this lifetime, which was a formless moment of consciousness, it wasn't made out of sperm and egg. It had no form, no shape. It was consciousness, just pure consciousness, and it was preceded by a former moment of consciousness, which is from a former lifetime. The sperm and egg, no question, that's the cause of this body. But the cause of this mind is a former moment of mind from former lifetimes. Okay? And so we've had countless former lifetimes. And in every former lifetime, we've had a mother. Okay? You cannot find the beginning of beginningless time, right? If you had a timeline and zero was right now and you started going backward, you could never find the first moment. You could never find the first moment of mind. Because before it was a moment before that, and a moment before that, and a moment before that. There's no beginning to consciousness. There's no beginning to the number of rebirths we've had. There's no beginning to the number of mothers that we've had. So we have to see that all living beings potentially, and this is the meditation, all living beings have been our mother. And that's a special relationship for most people, so we choose that relationship. So just imagine, you're surrounded right now. You can think of your mom of this life on your left hand side, and you can think of your father on your right, who was once your mother in the past lifetime, right? And then universal living beings, all in human form, and you imagine it, and you think to yourself, you know, all living beings have been my mother. All these countless living beings have been my mother. My mother of this life was my mother in a past life, and she'll be my mother again. And it's the same with all the other countless living beings. So just for a moment, do the see all sentient beings as your mother meditation. Again, you have to be willing to at least creatively align. Maybe you don't have conviction in rebirth, but just go with it. Give it a chance. See what happens to your mind. And you can imagine, you know, even the people, it's very helpful to be specific and, you know, even picking one or two people, like, you know, my younger brother is in the room tonight. He's sitting in the back. He's crashing this class, and I'm going, his name's Bob, but he used to be my mother in past lifetimes, countless times. He'll be my mother again in the future life. So really, it's really useful to see specific people in your life, maybe even work with one or two people, not just, when you say uniform, all sentient beings, that doesn't really evoke much in your heart, does it? When you think about it, for most of us it doesn't. But if you think, okay, my wife or my child was my mother in a past lifetime, many, many times she was my mother. You know, my co-worker wasn't my mother. This person that I'm having trouble with was my mother. Countless times. So it's very helpful to not be so general. Be very specific. One or two people and think, you know, Linda Saul, she's a mother in this life. She has her own family. But she's been my mother in former lifetimes. I just don't remember. I can't even remember what I had for breakfast yesterday. So no one, not surprising, I can't remember that Linda was my mother in a former lifetime. So we develop this attitude of seeing universal living beings as having been our mom. The next meditation is remembering their kindness. And so those of you who want to go there, and this meditation could go on for a long time, but I'm not going to dwell on it. But you don't have to think too much about it. But without your mom, well, number one, you wouldn't have a body, okay? You wouldn't be here. You wouldn't have a chance to play the game of life. I don't care if you hate your mother. You wouldn't be here. You would not have had a chance to play the game of life without her. So she gave you the opportunity to be a human being and to practice the path and even potentially get enlightened or at least plant the seeds for your future happiness and enlightenment. And then she, of course, our mother has, carried us for 9 months, went through all kinds of difficulties to bring us into the world. If she had a vaginal birth, then nowadays everybody has epidurals, but back in the day, having babies was painful. And it's really difficult to carry a baby for 9 months. It's really difficult. And then when the baby's born, all the sacrifices that your mom had to make on your behalf and waking up at night and feeding you, usually breastfeeding nowadays, but breastfed you and took care of you. Without your mother, you wouldn't have survived a day. Now maybe your dad was around and he could have saved the day, but without your mom, you would not have survived being an infant. You would not have survived. And then your mother taught you how to walk and talk and bought you clothes and took you places and showed you off, created all kinds of bad karma, bragging about you, all this kind of stuff. When you went to school the first day, she cried. She couldn't bear the thought of her baby leaving. And then when you graduated from high school and then finally from college and you got married, or whatever you did, every victory that you ever experienced was her victory. She celebrated it. She sacrificed. She put so much of herself up there. She loved you like nobody else could love you with her whole heart. If somebody said, hey, it's either you or your kid. One of you has to die. Your mom's hand would shoot up. Your mom would have died for you in an instant before she would let you die. That's how much, even in the animal world, look at animals. Mothers will sacrifice their life for their young ones. They do it. It happens all the time. That's the kind of love that our mother had for us. Sacrificing. It's a sacrificing love that our mother had for us. And every mother that we've ever had throughout space and time, these countless universal living beings have had that same love that our mom of this lifetime had that. So just for a moment, do the remembering the kindness of all our kind mother sentient beings, all living beings, remembering their kindness when they were our mother. And remember specifically one or two people that you're in your life. Don't make it so general. Like my brother Bob was so kind to me in past lifetimes. He's been kind to me in this lifetime. And future lifetimes he'll be kind to me. And Linda has been kind in past lifetimes and will be kind again in future lifetimes. You pick specific people. Don't be so general. Pick maybe just one person that you need to be working with or working on in terms of your relationship. People at work. Remember their kindness. And then the next thought is the wish to repay that kindness. Okay, now that's a kind of a, I've heard people criticize this one a little bit, but usually when somebody's kind to you, then there's a natural expectation that you repay that kindness. And so this is feeding off of that sort of normal human response. If somebody's been kind to me, then we should repay their kindness. It's not somebody else's responsibility to repay the kindness of all my kind Mother Cynthia. It's just my responsibility. So you meditate on the wish to repay the kindness of all these kind Mother Cynthia beings that we've had. But most specifically, we can go back to the one or two people. You can think about them as well. Not just universal living beings, but specific people that we must repay their kindness. And then we meditate. Then kind of spontaneously, you know, we feel this experience we call love, which in Buddhism we define it as the wish that others could have happiness and its causes. But that is not love, is it? It's a feeling. It's the experience of having done these other meditations well. Right? We feel that this feeling that if it could speak, it would go, may you have happiness and the causes of happiness. That's the love. So think about that, about these specific people, but also universal living beings. May you have happiness and the causes of happiness, which is what we call love. And then we reflect. The next meditation is on compassion. So remember, again, unless the stronger the love is, the stronger the compassion. And I'm not talking about love in the attached sense. I'm talking about, I guess, the Christian term agape. It's this selfless love. The stronger our sense of selfless love is, the stronger the compassion. Okay, you can see it. You can see it with a mother, for example, when they bring a child in. I can't remember. I mean, we've all seen it, right? We've all seen how when a baby suffers, a mother suffers. You know, I can remember just little experiences of having to, like, when I used to, back in the day, I used to work in emergency medicine. And we used to take little babies, and they would have a laceration, and we put them in a papoose, which is kind of brutal when you think about it. But anyway, they couldn't move, and then you put some stitches in and stitch them up, and the mom would be over there just freaking out, just so you could see the concern on her face. You know, she loved this baby so much. So the suffering that this child experiencing was she felt such a deep sense of empathy for the child. But see, compassion, the way we want to use compassion is not empathy in that sense where the mother's suffering. Because true compassion does not involve suffering. It's the wish that others could be happy and have the causes of happiness. Okay? So is it possible to have that kind of feeling of compassion without suffering? We see the suffering of the people that we love and that we're close to, but our thought is, may you be happy, I mean, may you be free of suffering and its causes. May you be free of suffering and its causes. Okay? That's compassion. That's a compassionate attitude that we aim to cultivate. Okay? So, love and compassion, crucial. And they work together. And the next meditation is on equalizing self and others. Okay? So again, we did this last time. We talked about how the Dalai Lama does it. But, you know, I mean, it's one of the most powerful ways to develop loving kindness. But it's holiness again. Every talk he ever gives, within about a minute of him starting to speak, he'll say, we're all the same. We all want to be happy. And we all do not want to suffer. We're all exactly equal in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. Okay? So whose happiness is more important? My happiness or your happiness? The happiness of one or the happiness of other? Now, by the way, others are how many? Infinite. Others are infinite. And me, I'm just one. So whose happiness is more important? The happiness of one or the happiness of infinite others? This is a little bit of, it's kind of a tough one, isn't it? Like, is my, because we, I know me. I don't know infinite others. I know I don't want to suffer, and I know they don't want to suffer. I know I want to be happy, and I'm pretty darn sure they want to be happy. But is their happiness more important than mine? Or is it less important than mine? Or is it equally important? Some teachers would say, and there are many examples of people who have given up their, the one person goes, you know, I'm just one person. I'll sacrifice my life for these others, which could be, you know, in a military situation, their fellow soldiers, and in a family situation, it could be one parent sacrificing their life for the whole family. Many examples of that, but here we're just trying to develop, and you know, this attitude of equalizing self and others. That self wants to be happy and doesn't want to suffer. Others want to be happy and don't want to suffer. And think of specific people, the people that, particularly the people that you live with and work with. You can look right into their hearts. You know one. You know something so intimate about them. You know something so intimate about them. In their heart of hearts, they have one thought. Well, they have a lot of thoughts, but this is, in their heart of hearts, they want to be happy. You say, do you want to be happy? Yes, I want to be happy. Do you want to suffer? No, I don't want to suffer. So we all want exactly the same. We all want to be happy. We don't want to suffer. We're exactly the same in wanting happiness and not wanting to suffer. So do this 1 minute meditation on equalizing self and others, not just universal living beings, that's fine, but be specific too. Be specific to one or two people that you interact with, possibly on a daily basis. When you look into their eyes, you go, hey, you want to be happy and you don't want to suffer. You're just like me. We're equal. We're exactly equal in that way. And then there's we look at the meditation on the faults of self-cherishing, selfishness. And I think I mentioned last time, but I just found this so helpful. Because we live in a culture, I hate to say it, but we're a very self-centered culture. I think the world culture, I mean human beings in general, for the most part, are going to looking after number one. Okay? My happiness is more important than others. And so we come from a place of self-cherishing selfishness. Ignorance projects a false sense of self, right? We call it there is an I. Buddhism doesn't negate the existence of an I, but it says that the self that we believe so strongly in is fictitious. We project the false sense of self. You know, we cling to it. It's called self-grasping ignorance. We cling to that sense of self. Like, I'm the most important thing in the world. I am the center of my universe. And if you offend me, I hate your guts. Or you become an enemy. Or you become an object of aversion. And if you're kind to me and treat me nicely, you become my friend and I like you. And if you're indifferent toward me, well, heck, the heck with you. You're a stranger. I don't care about you. Okay? So self-cherishing selfishness is the cause of killing, of all the wars, of all the divorces, of all the bad relationships, of all the bad stuff, of all the diseases in the world. Because all the negative karma is created by self-cherishing selfishness. Right? So killing and stealing and adultery, lying, slander, harsh and frivolous talk, greed, hatred and ignorance, all the 10 so-called 10 non-virtuous actions, all generated by self-cherishing selfishness. Our worst enemy, if there's a devil in the world, it lives in our heart, is selfishness. That's the problem. That's what's creating all the negative karma, is our selfishness, our self-cherishing selfishness. We have to identify it. We have to be honest about it and identify it and root it out. We have to see that it's completely false, that it's completely a fiction. We need to unravel it, but it takes time. It takes effort. It takes hard work. But we have to see that it's not our friend. Selfishness is not our friend. It looks like it's our friend, but it's our worst enemy. And cherishing others, our greatest friend. All happiness, Lama's Opus bumper sticker, for happiness, cherish others. All happiness comes from cherishing others. If we cherish others, would we kill them? Heck no. Would we steal from them? No. Would we commit adultery and behave in ways that are harmful sexually? No. Would we lie and deceive them? No. Would we slander and badmouth them? No. Would we waste their time with idle gossip or harsh speech? No. 84,000 delusions of the mind, all created by self-cherishing, and the antidote is cherishing others. We have to cultivate this attitude that cherishes others. Okay? The great benefits of cherishing others. We have to really contemplate that. Think about it. Again, Lama Yeshe said, check it out, dear. Don't buy this. The Buddha said, don't believe what I said based on just blind faith. That is stupid. It's not smart. It's not smart, and there's no conviction there. So when you do come up against hard times, you don't have any conviction. You don't have any Dharma practice to rescue. You don't have any source of real, true refuge. Real important to do the analysis, to think about these things and see if they're true. Then we talk about taking on other suffering. So this has to do with Tonglen, taking and giving. So again, I like the example of like Jesus on the cross. When I started doing this meditation, I really thought about it because I don't know the exact words in the Bible, but it was sort of like, I'm taking on the sins of the world. I'm taking on the sins of all living beings, and I'm going to give them everlasting happiness. I'm going to give them the kingdom of heaven. Just by having faith in me. Now, there's probably a lot more to it than that, but that's Tonglen. That's the action of taking on others' suffering, imagining. Just imagine, last week we worked with ourselves, but imagine just one other person, somebody that you care about this week. Not an enemy. You can gradually work with more and more difficult people, but you want to start with somebody that you dearly care about. You think about how they're suffering right now. And you think, may I take on their suffering? May I take on their suffering? And may I give them happiness? So taking on suffering is the action of compassion, isn't it? Remember? May you be free of suffering and its causes. So when we take on others' suffering, we're strengthening and cultivating the mind of compassion. And when we give them happiness and the causes of happiness, we're cultivating love. Okay? We're cultivating love. So this is Tonglen. The meditation that we're going to do in just a second is Tonglen, where we imagine that we're taking on the suffering of this person that we care about, and we're going to imagine giving them happiness. Okay? Now, by the way, I will back up just a second. And Tong Lin actually means giving and taking. It doesn't mean taking and giving. Okay? But in this particular meditation, and the way it's taught nowadays, is that we do the taking of the suffering first and giving happiness second. And the reasoning for that is that, well, if there's suffering, if you give them that happiness and its causes and all your merit and all your positive potential and everything, if you give that away, then they can't appreciate it if there's suffering. So we try to take away their suffering first. So it really ought to be Lin Tong. But it is taught as Tong Lin. And I think particularly if you're going to start doing this as a daily practice, it's particularly when you're working with strangers and people that you don't have any feeling for at all, sometimes it's kind of nice to be walking down the street. As you exhale, maybe you imagine exhaling some white light and you're thinking, may you be happy and have the causes of happiness. And then you inhale black smoke and may you be free of suffering and its causes. And you exhale happiness and inhale their suffering. You exhale your happiness and inhale their suffering. And you're practicing loving kindness and compassion. Now we're going to work with the person that you care about. You imagine this person's in front of you, and you think of the specific thing that they're experiencing right now. It could be many things. It could be mental and physical suffering. Okay? And you imagine this person in front of you, and all of their suffering begins to coalesce at the heart. All of it begins to coalesce at their heart about the size of an olive, a black olive. Okay? So I want you to see this. And you imagine that all of their suffering there, you can think of specific things. Maybe they're recovering from surgery today, like like Bob's wife is, or maybe they have mental or physical suffering. Whatever it is, you try to imagine all the suffering, be as specific as you can with this person. And it's now the size of a black olive. And I want you to imagine that olive, I want you to take 10 breaths and gradually imagine that olive, or that black sphere or orb of suffering begins to come toward you as you breathe, comes out through their nostrils and gradually comes toward you. And I want you to take about 10 breaths and bring it until it's right in front of your nose. Take 10 breaths to bring their suffering just to the tip of your nose. And you just imagine that little black sphere gradually coming toward you, toward the tip of your nose with each breath. Don't have to be in a hurry. Now imagine that this black little orb of suffering is at the tip of your nose, and at your heart is a lotus, and there's a flame on that lotus flower, and that flame symbolizes your selfish, self-cherishing mind, your worst enemy that's caused all the suffering for you and countless sentient beings from beginningless time, but this is your self-cherishing mind at your heart. And with the next breath, You're going to breathe in that sphere, that little orb of suffering from this person that you've been visualized in front. It's going to come down and it's going to meet the flame and go poof. The suffering will immediately disappear. The light of selfishness, self-cherishing will immediately disappear, like cigarette smoke, just disappear, completely disappear. So imagine that with this next breath. And so now we've destroyed this other person's suffering, and our self-cherishing mind is completely destroyed, and our body is completely fills with this light, this glowing light, golden light of it symbolizes all that's good, all that's loving, all of our virtues, all of our positive karma, all of our merit, all the goodness in the world that we can give. We're going to give to this person in the form of this light. And as we breathe out this light, and it goes toward this person like a stream. And as we breathe out, it gradually goes toward them. And we can take about 10 breaths and imagine it going toward them, and then this light entering their body and completely filling them with this energy of goodness and loving kindness, as we give them all of our happiness and the causes of happiness. And we imagine that they're happy. We imagine that whatever physical suffering that they've experienced, they've healed from that. Whatever mental suffering that they may have experienced, they've healed from that. We can, you know, we can take individuals, you know, with this meditation. You can take individuals. You can take whole groups of people, like all the people that are suffering mentally because of this pandemic in this whole planet. We can imagine, or individuals that are suffering from, you know, the experience of this pandemic. Whatever, you know, we can imagine all the beings that are suffering from cancer, all the beings that are suffering from depression, all the beings that are suffering from AIDS, all the beings that are suffering from fear of death, all the beings that are dying now and are freaking out and don't have peace of mind. And we imagine we're taking, you know, we can practice this Tonglen by taking on the suffering of others and giving them happiness and the causes. But now we're thinking that this one specific person now has happiness and the true causes of happiness. You know, their wishes have been fulfilled, and now we imagine that we've done this ourselves. We've personally taken on their suffering and we've given them happiness. And we've done it ourselves. And that leads to the next meditation, which is the supreme wish, or this sublime aspiration. The supreme wish. The supreme wish is, again, it's called by many names, but it's this wish. It's this determination to become enlightened. Just like we just practiced in this last meditation. Like, what does this person in front of us want? They don't want just to be, they want temporal happiness and physical happiness. They want supreme happiness. They want the happiness of supreme enlightenment. They want the happiness that's unshakable. That's what they really want. So we make the determination, I'm personally responsible for guiding this person and this person and this sentient being, universal living beings, but start out with real people, real beings that we can connect with. And we imagine, I am personally responsible for guiding this person, these people, from their wherever they are in their current state of suffering. And we all are suffering, aren't we? When we understand the depths of suffering, we understand that we're all like magnets for problems. We all have to deal with sickness and aging and death, and problems are queuing up. And we want to guide beings from wherever they are in suffering now to the supreme happiness of enlightenment of a Buddha. And we say, it's my responsibility. I take personal responsibility for doing that. I'm going to sacrifice whatever it takes. The word sacrifice has a bad connotation in this culture right now, but it's a wonderful, you know, the Buddha made incredible sacrifices to get enlightened. You know, sacrificing really, really important. So we're actually willing to do whatever it takes to get in. I'm personally responsible for the happiness of all living beings. I'm going to do whatever it takes to get there, to guide all living beings from suffering to supreme enlightenment. It's my job. That's the supreme wish. That's the attitude of a bodhisattva. It's the attitude, the Dalai Lama says, no matter how long it takes. What does he say? As long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, until then, may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. That's that supreme wish. So as outrageous as that sounds, just be open to that attitude, to developing. Even if you think, well, it's ridiculous, it can't be done. If it was doable, it would have been done. All of these things are true, but that's not the point. The point is for us to develop it, to develop the attitude of I'm, it's my responsibility to guide all living beings to supreme happiness, supreme enlightenment, by myself alone. That's how Lama Zopa says, by myself alone. Rinpoche says that. That's the purpose of my life. You want to know what the purpose of life is? This is it. To get in light, to guide living beings by yourself alone from whatever suffering they're experiencing to supreme enlightenment. I'm personally responsible for guiding beings to supreme enlightenment. It's my job. And then, again, all these other meditations up to now have led to this one, to this last step. And it's motivated not on sentimentality, not on, this megalomaniac sort of grandiose. It's based on reasoning and loving compassion. That it is possible. You have to have, it's helpful to have met a Buddha and met somebody that's enlightened. So you have some faith that it is possible to come enlightened. But when you have that faith that it's possible to become enlightened, and that you have Buddha potential, we all have the potential to become enlightened. So we set our goal sincerely, not just wishfully, but sincerely. Actually, in the beginning, it's a wish. It's called the wish for enlightenment. We set as our goal to become enlightened. And the reason we want to become enlightened is not just for our own happiness. Because if we wanted to just be blissed out and happy, we would have just gone for nirvana, the cessation of suffering. That's bliss. That is pure bliss. When suffering stops, what we experience is pure bliss. But this train just is going to the next station called full enlightenment of Buddhahood. The reason we want to become a Buddha is so we can guide others to that state. That's the only reason. I must become a Buddha in order to guide sentient beings from suffering to supreme enlightenment. That's the only person that can do it. That's the only being that can do it, is a Buddha. And I can't do it. I want to do it. I'd like to be able to do it, but I'm not a Buddha. I'm still trapped in samsara. So we develop this aspiration, this altruistic intention. I must become enlightened in order to guide all living beings to that state of full enlightenment. Based on love and compassion. This is bodhicitta. I must reach my full potential. I must eliminate my faults. I must become a fully enlightened Buddha if I want to truly liberate all living beings. And start with somebody in your family. Somebody that's real to you. Because all sentient beings is too big right now for us. Start with real people, real situations. You know, somebody in your family that's dead, and you know how they're suffering. And you go, I must practice ethics. I must develop concentration. I must develop wisdom, the three higher trainings. I must develop renunciation. I must cultivate this bodhicitta, bodhiman. I must develop the wisdom of a Buddha. I must practice all the stages of the path, you know, the bodhisattva path, you know, and the tantric path, the generation and completion stage of tantra. I must practice the full Mahayana path to become enlightened. I must practice, and it's all been laid out. It's all been laid out for us by qualified teachers. We have this amazing opportunity to practice. And if we don't make it to Buddhahood this lifetime, let's plant the seeds now that will ripen at some point in the future as Buddhahood. That's the goal. Maybe we can't get there in this lifetime, but it's our aspiration. It's our aspiration to eliminate our negativities, develop our good qualities to the fullest extent possible in order to liberate, you know, universal living beings. And again, important to start with one person, two people, three people. Don't make it so big that you can't relate to it. As I said, as I was reading at the very beginning, Venerable Lobsangatsa in the book, he said, it's the quintessence of all Buddhist scriptural systems, a fabulous ambrosia of Dharma. The mere thought of it, it is bodhicitta, can banish all mental woes. Since it is one of the qualities that bodhisattvas hold dearest to their hearts, those of us who really want to engage in the Mahayana path should train meticulously in the cultivation of this mind. So, let's relax our concentration. And bodhicitta, the meditations, and we're going to do it again because repetition is a good thing. Maybe we'll bring in a few other points or emphasize some more points next time. Maybe do a little bit more Tonglen meditation. Tonglen's always, you know, we can gradually escalate until we can actually, eventually, you'd like to be able to take the people that you label enemy and imagine that you're taking on their suffering and giving them happiness. By the way, this is a great practice. You know, a lot of Buddhist scriptures will say that so-and-so was a Buddhist saint, and every breath he took or she took, they were practicing Tonglen nonstop, imagining as their in breath and out breath were equal, right? As they were breathing in, when they were with other people or with one person or with a lot of people or with no, just imagining universal living beings, with every breath they imagined taking on suffering. And with every out breath they imagined in breath bringing in suffering, out breath giving happiness. So just, you know, let's use that as our dedication for a moment. Just with each breath, maybe for the next 10 or so breaths, imagine that you're taking on, and you can imagine black smoke in, white light out, like that if you want to, or you can just imagine mentally thinking, I'm taking on suffering, I'm giving happiness, I'm practicing compassion, practicing loving kindness like that. So just do that, and then all day this next week, as much as you can, do this with every breath. Even if you can only remember it once or twice in the next week, that'll be great. But if you can remember it every day, when you're going about your day-to-day activities, practicing with each inhalation, taking on suffering of others, and with exhalation, giving happiness. So let's do that now. So again, you know, taking on suffering is the practice of compassion, giving happiness, practice of loving kindness. So, you know, what better way to spend your time thinking of compassion and loving kindness? What better way to die? What better way to die? When we die, if we can bring this, we can practice Tonglen, taking on the suffering of everybody that's dying at this moment, as I'm dying. And may my death, you know, may I experience the suffering of all sentient beings who are fearful and dying right now. And may I give them my happiness, and may they be completely at peace. What a great attitude to have as we pass away from this life into the next life. So we need to cultivate this. This is so powerful, so helpful. So, thank you. Your job this week is to do these meditations, and in between meditations, practice Tong Lin with every breath. Be mindful of Tong Lin. Be mindful of taking on suffering, giving happiness. So, thank you. Signing off. Anything? Pardon?
Unmute everyone and let everyone say goodbye.
Okay. Bye.
Bye, everybody.
So, what do I do?
Bye. See y'all next time.
Bye. Yeah. Thank you for showing up. I appreciate it. Because otherwise I wouldn't get a chance to do this. And I love it. I love Bodhicitta. All right.